Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Well, thanks for coming along tonight on this wet Sydney winter's evening. It's great to have Tony Burke at the Sydney Institute. Tony Burke has been one of our members for a long time, I think virtually since the foundation of the Institute. So it's great to have him along as a senior member of the Labor government. I'll introduce our speaker very briefly. He graduated in arts and law. He was a member of the Legislative Council in New South Wales, went into federal politics as the member for Watson in 2004, was appointed to the Rudd Ministry in 2007, and has continued there, and currently the Minister for Sustainability, Water, Environment, Population and Communities. Now, Mr. Burke is going to talk for us tonight on the... We've listed the topic on the Murray-Darling, but I think it's fair to say that he will talk generally across the areas of sustainability as affect his portfolio. So, Tony Burke, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jared, and good evening all. There are three iconic environmental issues which are currently before us. Climate change, the Murray-Darling Basin, and the protection of our national parks. They have a lot in common. Not long ago, all three brought bipartisan support. All three were the product of shared values. All three are now in the thick of partisan politics. How much has changed in 2 years? In 2007, on one occasion, John Howard seemed to tell the Parliament he believed the jury was still out on the connection between human activity and climate change. He was back in the House of Representatives within hours, explaining that he'd misheard the question and stated that he believed the science was in fact clear and settled. He then went to the 2007 election, backing the Shergold report and committing to an emissions trading scheme. That was about the same time that Malcolm Turnbull, as Water Minister, brought forward the Water Act, which committed the Australian government to restoring the balance in the Murray-Darling Basin. And throughout the last century, there's often been controversy about establishing national parks, but there's been a continuing bipartisan consensus that once a national park was established, the level of protection would not be reversed. In short, there would be no backward steps. In 2011, the Liberal Party, under Tony Abbott, attends rallies to ridicule science and finds itself in a situation where the consensus on that full range of issues, which was there for so long, is now gone and gone completely. And I'm now going to switch to the paper copy, Jared. If I may. Thank you. Thank you very much. It was going so well. In 2011, as I said, the Liberal Party under Tony Abbott attends rallies to ridicule science and opposing pricing carbon. He's committed to rip $600 million out of water recovery on the basis that it has now rained, and the Victorian government wants to use the Alpine National Park as though it were a farm. These three iconic issues, climate change, the Murray-Darling Basin, and national parks, are not a bad overview of Australia's environmental needs. They cover the atmosphere, our water, and our land. In each case, the approach of the Gillard Labor government is to back the science, to act to protect the assets for future generations, and, importantly, to use market mechanisms to achieve these outcomes. Some commentators have suggested that there's an irony in Labor being the party which is backing the market system while the Liberals rail against it. Well, I think that's wrong, dead wrong. For more than 30 years, the major market reforms have all belonged to Labor. Banking deregulation, floating the dollar, and competition policy were reforms not when the Treasurer was John Howard, but when the Treasurer was Paul Keating. This approach has reached every area of policy. If I look at my own responsibilities last term as Minister for Agriculture, Fisheries and Forestry, I was responsible for the abolition of the AWB monopoly on the sale of wheat, for the reform of drought policy. Both of these were squarely aimed at giving farmers the autonomy to act within the market. A market approach is good environmental policy for the same reason that it's good economic policy. It allows a policy to be a goal to be achieved by the most efficient means. In the examples I want to talk about tonight, the policy goals are straightforward: reducing CO2 equivalent emissions, increasing the amount of environmental water, and protecting and preserving our biodiversity. Some of the most straightforward scientific evidence on the causes of climate change is actually contained within my own portfolio. In Hobart, within my department, we have the Australian Antarctic Division, and it includes a team of extraordinary scientists dedicated to a range of disciplines. One section collects and studies ice cores. The principles of these shafts of ice are simple. When I was last down there, I was holding one that itself was 2,000 years old. They're collected from areas which receive regular compounding snowfall each year. As the snowflakes fall, they seal bubbles of air, which remain then unchanged until one day the ice melts. The deeper you go to collect the ice core, the older it is. The air bubbles tell the story of the atmosphere. The qualities of the ice itself, the water therein, are a guide to the temperatures of the time. This simple combination of depth, air, and water allows scientists to track over decades and centuries gone how CO2 levels have changed and how temperatures have changed with them. It's true that over time these levels have always varied to some degree, but there's one point that there is a spike in emissions and temperature like nothing before, and from which we never return. The spike precisely coincides with the growth in the use of fossil fuels during the Industrial Revolution. This is only one of the many indicators which has been used in the development of the science. It's the same science which has caused action around the world to reduce CO2 equivalent emissions. It's why around 85 countries have renewable energy targets, either legislated or planned. It's why 32 countries have national carbon trading schemes and why 10 countries have introduced a carbon tax. The majority of developed and developing nations now have energy efficiency initiatives which are reducing carbon pollution. That's why the Gillard government is committed to taking action on climate change. We've committed to cutting our carbon pollution by at least 5% by 2020. This 5% target is intermittently a bipartisan target. Where there has been no bipartisanship for more than 18 months is on the method to achieve this reduction. Our approach is to price carbon and then allow the market to drive the most efficient pathway to achieve the reduction in carbon pollution. The opposition's approach is for government to directly intervene in ways that will either reduce emissions or sequester carbon. Instead of a price-driving market behaviour and allowing business to use its own ingenuity and move to a clean energy future, the opposition approach relies on decisions being taken and led by government officials. The simplicity of the opposition's interventionist approach does make it easier to turn it into slogans. The price doesn't fall to the politician who explains it. The price falls to the taxpayer who ends up footing the bill for bad policy. The $720 a year taxpayer bill imposed by Mr Abbott's approach is not a one-off. It becomes a permanent impost which can only go up over time. When you price carbon, the market finds the lowest cost for that abatement. When you adopt the direct action or government intervention model, the cost of abatement multiplies. Australia's approach prices carbon from 1 July next year and moves to a full emissions trading scheme in 2015. While most of the public discussion has been about the impacts of around 500 high-polluting businesses paying the carbon price, the great strength is not when they pay it, but when they avoid paying it by changing behaviour. When pollution is no longer free, businesses will innovate. They will invest. They will change to improve their bottom line, and in so doing, they will reduce their carbon pollution. The targets will be met, and the market will drive the most efficient pathway. There is a tendency in policy debate these days to want to run every issue as though it's a sporting event. Sport demands one thing, a scoreboard. And the scoreboard which is developed in reform of the Murray-Darling Basin is the total volume for the environment across the basin. But the total volume doesn't tell the story of the individual catchment, nor does it provide definitive information about end-of-system flow. Now, this is in part because the hydrology of the southern connected Murrumbidgee and Murray systems and the northern Darling system, the hydrology of each of those is entirely different. The southern system has deeper rivers, and if I were to buy, for example, 1 megalitre of water at the beginning of the Murray system in Victoria or New South Wales, by the time that 1 megalitre makes it through to the Murray mouth, most of it's still there. Most of it hasn't been lost to seepage or to evaporation. But the northern system spills out into a network of wide open lakes and marshes where the losses to evaporation and seepage are massive. If I buy 1 megalitre of environmental water in the Darling in Queensland, then very little of it, and in fact in some years none of it, will ever reach the mouth of the Murray. It's the backyard garden that you want to water, and the taps a distance away. For the southern system, you've got a soaker hose, and it's connected, and while some of the water leaks on the way, most of it reaches the garden. For the northern system, there's no hose. You just turn on the tap, it washes through the lawn, and eventually, if you're lucky, some of it reaches the garden. Now, the difference between these two means any total number across the basin, depending on where you're getting that environmental water, will give a completely different answer at the end of the basin. The environmental test for Murray-Darling, for the Murray-Darling Basin plan, therefore, isn't simply the total volume preserved for environmental flows. It's the environmental outcome that's achieved. There are minimum environmental standards which need to be achieved in the interests of the total health of the system. These environmental standards are far more important than a simple scoreboard conversation about the total number. The minimum standards are as essential for the environment as they are for the communities which rely on healthy rivers. The mouth of the Murray should be open 9 years out of 10. Icon sites such as the Narran Lakes, the Macquarie Marshes, the Barmer Millewa Forest and Hatter Lakes need to be restored to long-term health. Good health doesn't simply mean a mass of water. It involves trying to use environmental water to more closely resemble natural flows. The use of weirs and levees means that the system, which once had undulating flows, now virtually flatlines, except in a flood year when you get the spike. Smart and efficient environmental water use, including through environmental works and measures, needs to allow these icon sites to go through something closer to a normal wet and dry cycle. You can never and should never remove all the levees and weirs, so we have to keep the health of the system, get as close as we can to a natural cycle for the environmental assets along the way. The completely dry years that you get after years of drought and the years when you have massive floods like we just have won't look all that different if you're just looking at the water in the system. At the depth of drought, it will look dry, and in the midst of flood, it'll look wet. And so the reform's not going to make a whole lot of difference to how the water looks in those periods. But if environmental water is used smartly and strategically in the in-between years, then these magnificent sites will approach the extremes of drought and flood in much better health, and they'll have a level of resilience when the major weather events occur. Building this resilience in the in-between years is perhaps the greatest strength of water reform. Achieving these environmental outcomes needs to be underpinned by the best available science, because we don't have a whole lot of water to get that balance right. Less water will flow through the Murray in 1 year than will flow through the Amazon in 1 day. If we extract too much for consumption, the health of the system is wrecked, and communities understandably, on the flip side, want to ensure the impact on social and economic outcomes is properly taken into account. Even though it's our food bowl, we don't have a lot of water to work with. If we get it right, the outcomes are extraordinary. For the environment, we restore the health of water birds, fish, the mighty river red gums and coolabahs, the water purifying reeds and marshes, the migratory species, white-faced heron, the yellow-billed spoonbill, the curiously titled bird known as Latham's snipe, all the turtles of the lower lakes, which were suffering from shell rot while salinity levels went through the roof. It would be a mistake, though, to ignore the social and economic benefits of healthy rivers. These include groundwater replenishment, increased carbon and nutrient recycling leading to improved soil and water quality, stabilisation of riverbanks through healthy riparian vegetation, improved pollination and pest management through biodiversity, and of course, when the mouth of the Murray is open, that water is not wasted. That water discharges salt throughout the entire system and flushes out the system, allowing a healthy basin. The system approached the last drought with so little resilience that we saw too many algal blooms, acid sulphate soils, high salinity, and we nearly witnessed an acidification crisis in the lower lakes. So those standards provide me with the lens to interrogate any set of numbers. The question then becomes, how do we implement the reform once the plan is in place? For me, the answer is straightforward. We need to use the water market and improve efficiency through a principle of localism. People sometimes suggest there should be direct government intervention that prevents Australia from growing crops such as rice. This approach is wrong. Our way of securing water for the environment needs to be to recover water from those who make the market decision to voluntarily sell all or part of their entitlement. I'm not in the business of telling farmers what to do with their land. Our farmers are innovative, they do understand their markets. If the most profitable use of water in a particular year is to grow rice rather than to grow a different crop, then that is a decision for the grower. What matters for the reform is that we have the water preserved for environmental purposes that keeps the system healthy. That means we need to be regularly in the market, purchasing water from those who wish to sell. If someone doesn't want to sell their water, then we don't want to buy it. There is no forced acquisition. We need to strategically align these purchases with the numbers that are in the basin plan, and we'll be able to start doing this after the authority releases the draft. By 2019, we need to have recovered enough water in each catchment to hold the entitlements that are ultimately contained within the basin plan. This commitment to steadily bridge the gap year after year is the reason communities are able to adjust slowly and steadily to basin reform. The use of the market is the protection for irrigators to ensure no property rights are infringed. This market approach also ensures the vast majority of water which irrigators choose to keep is directed to the most efficient and commercial use. Unsurprisingly, This market-based approach is the key part of water reform, which has been opposed by Tony Abbott's opposition. Earlier this year, he pledged to defer $600 million in money for water recovery. He claimed this was possible because it had rained. The deadline for reaching the targets in the Basin Plan doesn't move beyond 2019. That means deferring the next few years of buyback doesn't change the final deadline. When challenged, the opposition stated that it agreed with our approach of only buying from those who put their water on the market. So, when you rule out compulsory acquisition, how do you still meet the 2019 date if you follow Tony Abbott's plan of deferring the water buyback? The only option is to simply go on a massive spending spree for water in the last few years. And if you do that, in a market system, you end up in the worst of all worlds. The community adjustment becomes abrupt rather than gradual, which creates serious challenges in many areas. And wanting to buy large volumes of water in a short period of time can only end one way in a competitive market. The price of water would spike at precisely the time Mr. Abbott was in the market wanting to buy. This would leave the taxpayer with a much larger bill than the $600 million that had earlier been deferred. Reaching the requirements of the Basin Plan doesn't only rely on direct rounds of strategic water purchase. There's been a great frustration that infrastructure money has been too slow in getting out the door. I'm currently in negotiations with my state colleagues to provide them with an additional option in the expenditure of infrastructure funds. Instead of always embarking on infrastructure projects as a Commonwealth-state partnership, we're developing an outcomes-based approach that will allow for more locally driven solutions. This would see the states having much more autonomy over their water infrastructure projects in the basin in return for a guaranteed ratio of water to be returned to the Commonwealth Environmental Water Holder. While these discussions are not yet concluded, I am optimistic about the goodwill and constructive approach around the table. I agree with the statements that have been made today by the Victorian Minister for Water, Peter Walsh, that it is in everyone's interest for these negotiations to have concluded before the draft plan is released. Through these approaches, we focus on outcomes. We don't follow a path of direct intervention, but instead we allow maximum flexibility for all parties so long as the outcomes of water reform are achieved. We let the market deliver the outcomes we need. The issue of national parks is the one where the collapse of political consensus surprises me the most. It isn't new to have controversy over whether or not new lands are put into national parks. That's actually pretty standard. But an area once protected usually has the principle apply that there shall be no backward steps. New areas for national parks frequently have existing commercial uses that are phased out or scaled back over time. But those commercial uses end. Once they end, we don't talk about going back on it. For all the controversy back in the 1990s when Bob Hawke protected Coronation Hill, no one would now suggest that we open new mines in Kakadu National Park. No one would now propose the damming of the Franklin, the drilling of the Great Barrier Reef, or the clear felling of parts of the Dane Tree. So it beggars belief that last summer the Victorian government sought to reintroduce grazing to the Alpine National Park and made announcements today that they continue with that process. This ran against the grain in so many ways. The mountain cattlemen had previously been paid compensation when the cattle grazing was discontinued. The environment of the Alpine National Park is already under serious distress from a number of invasive species, including deer. The so-called scientific study, which was used as an attempted justification by the Victorian government, was commenced without a baseline survey of the sites before the cattle arrived. They just put the cattle in without checking what the state of the national park was like before the cattle were there. The crass claim that this was a solution to future bushfires ignored the fact that none of the recommendations in the Royal Commission into the Victorian bushfires had called for an action of this nature. There are new ways that the federal government is expanding the parts of our continent that are preserved for biodiversity. As you would expect from this government, we're using market mechanisms to do this. Since we came to office, we've established the Environmental Stewardship Program, where private landholders are paid for continued management of high-quality and precious native vegetation and wildlife. In choosing to voluntarily covenant parts of their land for 20 years and to enter into 20-year contracts with the Australian government, many farmers are making decisions that combine conservation with the commercial. Environmental protection and market-driven improvements also intersect with some of the mechanisms available under the Carbon Farming Initiative. Through voluntary offset markets, farmers can be paid for a number of actions which sequester carbon in the soil, including when they improve biodiversity and revegetate parts of their land. Once again, this method doesn't work because of direct government intervention and control. It works because we're working with the market to deliver an outcome. And it follows a consistent theme. It's a market-driven reform promoted by the Gillard Labor government and voted against by Tony Abbott's opposition. There are further market-driven gains in our approach to the National Reserve System, which I hope to be able to announce in coming weeks. As part of the Clean Energy Future package, the government announced a biodiversity fund worth nearly $1 billion. This is to improve biodiversity, not to compensate for backward steps taken at a state level. But all of these policies, environmental stewardship, carbon farming, the National Reserve System, the Biodiversity Fund, only help if we are genuinely building on solid foundations of areas that have already been designated for environmental protection. It only works if we keep to the principle of no backward steps. That's why I was so alarmed by the approach of the Victorian government last summer and today. Industrial development, climate change and invasive species put enough pressure on our biodiversity without governments deliberately taking backward steps. Treating a national park like a farm is a clear backward step. The precise nature of the so-called trial and the failure of the Victorian government to refer the issue for federal approval meant I was able to insist the cattle be removed from the park. But national powers in national parks are not yet clear. The international conventions which form the basis of national environmental law do not apply to all national parks, but they do apply to most. This week, I'm writing to my state colleagues to seek their views on extending national environmental law to better protect those areas with high biodiversity and which state governments have chosen to designate for land-based protection, such as national parks, as matters of national environmental significance under national environmental law. It would only apply where states choose to designate the land as national park. It would not affect any existing activities. It would only be triggered when there is attempt to introduce new mining, logging, grazing, or significant and inappropriate land clearing. States would still have full control over the boundaries of national parks. But where national parks exist and have high biodiversity, national parks would be considered of national environmental significance and protected under national law. I can think of no occasion where this would be triggered in recent memory other than the bizarre example we saw last summer. But the principle of no backward steps in our national parks is one worth defending. It underpins the many market-driven approaches that the government is putting in place. Market-driven approaches have choice at their core. They accept the principle of subsidiarity, that decisions are best made at the most local level possible. Market mechanisms allow government objectives in the national interest to be made plain and for businesses to help drive the most efficient pathway to reach the destination. Direct government intervention is easier to turn into slogans, but it's far less efficient. In carbon policy, under direct action, only a quarter of the required abatement is delivered by 2020. In water policy, under an interventionist model, the cost of recovery for the environment can be up to 10 times more expensive. The outcome of the less efficient model is really simple. Either the policy outcome is never achieved, or the taxpayer receives a massive ongoing bill. It's a high price to pay for the sake of a slogan. The market reforms of the 1980s and 1990s were controversial at the time, and by definition, more complex to explain than the simplicity of direct government intervention. Yet these days, the controversy is gone. It's gone for a very simple reason. The incontrovertible proof of market mechanisms is lived experience. When people see for themselves the fear campaign was wrong, then the fear campaign is gone. In the interim, there is an opportunity for cheap slogans to back in hopeless policy. It's an opportunity that the opposition finds strangely appealing. Well, we don't. In dealing with climate change, water reform, and biodiversity, we use the best available science as a reference point to design the targets we need to reach. Then we seek to optimise the outcomes for our economy and our communities, and we drive the reform using the same consistent approach which Labor governments have adopted for nearly 30 years, market reform.
Many thanks to the Minister, sir. We'll have question discussion time and finish later than 7 o'clock. So before I call the Minister in for questions and discussion, I should say many thanks to Maria McNamara and to the legal partners at Mannix for the use of this great facility today. So we'll come to questions and discussion. Minister, you mentioned climate change, water reform, biodiversity. As you know, the opposition is locked into a position on climate change. But in relation to the other two issues, if there is legislation there, you will only need the support of the Greens if you don't have the support of the coalition. So how are your discussions going with your counterpart, your shadow ministerial counterpart, and with the coalition, the Senate, about some of your other proposals getting through without having to get the support of the Greens?
My preference in market reform is that you deliver market certainty. And the best way to deliver market certainty is to provide bipartisan support. So my first port of call, routinely, is to meet with the relevant shadow minister, whether environmental reform, that be Greg Hunt, or whether in water reform, that be Barnaby Joyce. It is their call whether or not I need to negotiate with crossbenchers as well. But routinely, where bipartisan support is possible, then you provide the best form of market reform, and that is where there is certainty for the market that a change of government doesn't change the underpinnings for their investment. So I continue to do that. On the carbon farming initiative, the opposition decided that they would vote against that market initiative, so we had to go to the crossbench to make sure that it was carried, and it was. On water reform, we will end up with a legislative instrument in the first few months of next year that will be presented to me from the Murray-Darling Basin Authority, chaired by Craig Knowles. Once we have that instrument, it can then be disallowed by either House of the Parliament. The coalition at any point can declare that they are willing to provide bipartisan support for the approach that I'm taking. If they don't do that, I will still be trying to get a majority because I want to make sure that the reform is delivered. The worst of all outcomes is no reform, and I don't intend on landing there. Whether or not we go to the crossbenchers on any issue, we always have the consultation. You keep people in the loop whether you need their vote or not, and you have those conversations. But whether or not the crossbench is the critical issue on whether or not something gets through the Parliament remains entirely in the gift of the opposition.
Okay, so right down the back. Yep, and then next, and then we come up here. We've got plenty of time. Yeah.
So why wouldn't the coal seam gas extraction
Could you just repeat the question? Why would not the coal extraction where?
Coal seam gas extraction in Hillier, New South Wales, be considered a backward step?
If I can deal with the coal seam gas approvals that I made, if that's okay, and they're the ones in Queensland that around areas such as Dalby and that go through the gas hub out at Gladstone. The critical question for coal seam gas is what impact are you having on the water table or in the Great Artesian Basin? And the original application that came to us presumed that the coal seams were effectively watertight, which means that when you withdraw the water, if they're watertight, you don't get a pullback effect for the Great Artesian Basin, and you don't have an impact on the water outside of those coal seams. The advice that I received from Geoscience Australia said that you can't be sure, because it's going to be different seam to seam. Some of them will be watertight, in which case they won't have an impact on the water table. Some of them probably won't be, and if they're porous, you can get a drawback effect. So the conditions that I put in place said to the proponents, be it Santos, be it BG, we had a number of applicants there, but for each of them they had the same conditions, which was you have to test every seam. And if the seam, and you can test it, it's relatively simple, if the seam comes out as being watertight, then that's fine, and you simply go ahead with the extraction. If the seam is found to not be watertight, it's found to be porous, then you either have to repressurise or re-inject all the water back into the seam when you're finished. And I believe that was an environmentally responsible way of making sure that we weren't unreasonably holding back investment, but at the same time, we were making sure that one of the great natural assets of this nation, the Great Artesian Basin, wasn't being compromised. I said in the introduction that I would deal with the one that I'd given approval to. I'm not going to pretend to be across the detail of in a way that I was when I put forward 300 conditions on an example. I'm not going to pretend to be across the detail of ones that haven't yet come to me.
Now, there are a lot of people here, and I'm running this, so just don't mind. Just down the back. Yeah.
You mentioned imported food bottle, but presumably if buyback is successful, we are going to reduce the food bottle. How are the irrigators responding to the new policy, and to what extent will it reduce both communities and food bottle in the future?
The most telling statistic in water recovery is this. In the buyback program, two-thirds of the water we buy is people selling a portion of their entitlement. These are people where they have found further efficiencies, where they had an entitlement beyond their requirements to be able to run their business, and they've taken advantage of a tradable asset, and that we're a buyer in the market. So the concept that all water recovered is water coming out of production is not quite right, because two-thirds of what we buy is actually water which is being recovered in situations where greater efficiencies have been found and people have decided to trade an asset that they hold in part. They're still there, they're still irrigating, they're still in business. Of the other part that needs to be remembered is almost double the amount of money that's invested in direct water recovery goes into improvements in efficiency. The problem has been we've had trouble getting that money out the door. But when you drive that many billions of dollars into improving the efficiency, coupled with the fact that elsewhere most of what we're buying is only a partial sale, I don't accept the premise that we're actually going to have a deeply significant impact on total production. And if there is a price, it's a price to pay for the health of the basin, which irrigators need as much as the environment.
There's a question down there. Yes.
Speak up a bit. Yeah, in relation to your comment about funds coming more to the states to fund the infrastructure work, set up the process, do you envisage something like a state-based infra model, or the NDVA, Craig Nullis has said, probably an independent authority?
Okay. I want it to be their call. The way we do it at the moment, and the way we've been doing it for the last 3 years, is there's money allocated to each state. They bring forward their projects. We then go through a complex due diligence assessment and basically get our hands on every shovel and work out what we think of the project as to whether or not we want to be a partner in it. That level of bureaucracy, I have a general view that you're better off putting someone in charge and telling them it's their job. Now, what I want to do is I want to make sure that infrastructure work helps us bridge the gap, and that takes some of the pressure off buyback. So that's the objective I want. I would rather say to the states, you've got your money, you spend it, so long as it's on water infrastructure, you basically get very close to free rein on how you spend it, what your governance methods are. But there is a defined ratio as to how much water has to be returned to the Commonwealth Environmental Water Holder for doing it. But the level of detail you refer to, I deliberately don't want that to be my call. I think me having a joint decision-making power on issues like that has been part of the joint hold-up that we've had and the frustration the communities have felt.
Right, so there's a question here. Mr. I'm trying to pick you up on the microphone here. So, yep.
My understanding is that the largest cotton property in southern Queensland on the New South Wales border in the darkest days of the last drought was insolvent and for sale. Did the federal government buy it?
Well, unsurprisingly, the answer is no. I presume you're referring to Cubby Station. And there is always the question when you're dealing with taxpayers' money and you're dealing with a very, very expensive asset of the extent to which someone is engaging in a genuine commercial transaction for value for money, or the extent to which someone's trying to get as much money from the Commonwealth as they possibly can. The request for the Commonwealth to buy Cubby went through a number of iterations, but some of the detail we read about in the papers before we'd received the request formally from them, which gives you some indication of the negotiations for parts of that. The other problem that happened during that time was at that stage, and the water market, while I refer to the market reform, it's still a very immature market. And when the first proposal was there for us to buy Cubby, at that point you could not buy the water asset without buying the land. And we did not have a national interest in purchasing that land. You still have the problem with the water entitlements there that I described to with the hydrology of the Northern Basin. Doesn't necessarily helps with your environmental assets up there. Once you get past Menindi Lakes, not much more of the water makes it except in a flood year. So the short answer to your question, which I presume you knew when you asked, is no, we didn't buy it. And I think we made the right commercial decision in not doing that and the right dealing with taxpayers' money. We've continued to have tender rounds in the Lower Boulogne, which is a catchment for that property, and the owners are welcome to participate in a tender round at any point, and the tenders will be determined on value for money.
No, okay. We're going to have but just a minute, an opportunity but better than that previous tender
okay.
round.
We've got to move on because we've got a lot of people here. Yes.
Yeah. You've talked lucidly about the need to listen to science in regards to environmental decision-making and singled out Tony Abbott as one that doesn't regularly do so. But in regards to the Murray-Darling process, the Wentworth group of scientists have walked away feeling disenchanted and disillusioned, and disenfranchised. How are you going to win their confidence back? And the second question is, you've highlighted three iconic areas of Australia's environment: national parks, Murray-Darling, and climate change. There's one other I feel, and that's the current despoilation of the Kimberley. Can you give us an update on what's happening there?
Okay, I'll tell you about my portfolio. if I deal them in reverse order, on the Kimberley, I have two issues coming before me. One is a national heritage listing for the West Kimberley. I have advice, most of which has been made public now, from the National Heritage Council on that listing. I'm intending to make that decision before the end of August. The second issue that will come to me is a strategic assessment on the gas hub proposal at James Price Point. On that, I will have a very limited discretion. I will not be able to choose, do I think there's a better site? I'll have one question and one question only when it comes to me, which is this site an appropriate one or not? And I can't prejudge that decision before the advice comes to me. But that's what's happening with the Kimberley. The other part of the question, sorry, was
The Wentworth Group. They're all disillusioned.
Even when the Wentworth Group withdrew from their involvement formally with the Murray-Darling Basin Authority, individual members of the Wentworth Group continued to meet with the Murray-Darling Basin Authority. You need to remember with this that there are some parts of the basin for which, some of the environmental sites for which the science is very limited. We have icon sites which are well measured and the science is quite robust. We also have thousands of smaller sites where the measurement and knowledge is very limited and where judgment calls are made. So I think we need to be upfront about the areas where the science is truly robust and the areas where there are judgment calls along the way.
Can I ask you a question about what we've all been urged about of late, which is not to talk crap? So we're very conscious here tonight. None of us is talking crap. So, but in relation, what do you tell people? I mean, you're a very responsible minister. So what do you tell people about water? Because we've had quite authoritative people like Tim Flannery suggesting that Perth and Adelaide and Sydney and Brisbane would run out of water. Malcolm Fraser saying that Melbourne is running out of water. I'm sure someone said that Hobart was running out of water. That doesn't seem to be happening. Now, how do you get over these past exaggerations that came out of the drought to sell the kind of sensible message you're talking about tonight, which is one of caution and consideration in view of all these quite extreme statements about water which have been made within the last 1 or 2 years by quite well-qualified Australians who normally wouldn't be considered as talking crap?
I think the reason in part that we don't have the crises that might have been predicted is when those predictions were made, there was a policy response. There's a whole lot of controversy.
But there was also rain.
Which which is also the hardest thing to predict. Yeah. Let's not forget the rain across Queensland. You could have had most of the floods that we had in Queensland without the Murray-Darling getting any of it. And in previous years, we had floodwaters that all ran out to sea through Rockhampton, and then a year later, floodwaters that all washed up north to the Gulf of Carpentaria and then went west to Lake Eyre. And it all kept missing the basin. So there's a level of roulette in rainfall predictions as well. For capital cities, there is one capital city where the desal is popular, and it's Perth. And the sorts of predictions that had once been made about Perth running out of water have largely been a combination of strict water restrictions and policy changes like building a desalination plant are the reason they've been able to dodge a bullet.
So there's a question here, and we go over there. Yes? Speak up.
Minister, during the drought, under natural conditions, seawater would have entered the lower lakes. Would you like to comment on the management of the barrages in that regard?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is where the lower lakes, most of you be aware, best way of describing that area is the movie Storm Boy. It's that whole Coorong area, magnificent area. And it is true that there are barrages there holding the seawater back. Now, in a completely natural system, it's true. The barrages wouldn't be there. It's also true, in a completely natural system, there would be no weirs or levees or dams anywhere back up the basin. And if you wanted a completely natural system, which is the argument that's sometimes put about removing the barrages, then the flip side of that argument is, would you also remove all the levees, dams and weirs going back up through the basin, and then you would get a natural system? Because if you don't do that, and you're holding the water back artificially in other places, your salinity will push much, much further up than it ever would naturally. And that's why, while it can feel strange defending an environmental intervention, it needs to be seen in the context of the other interventions on which our food bowl relies. And that does put the lower lakes in a different situation.
May I have a supplement?
No. But we then have time. If you have time, we'll come back. Yes, a question there.
Minister, you told us convincingly what you're doing for the health of the animal population. What are you doing for the health of the human population by reducing air pollution and more other measures?
There's a question about air pollution and the human population.
In terms of the atmosphere, at a federal level, the carbon emissions part of it is the only part we directly deal with. Your general pollution, your other toxins in the air, are regulated entirely at a state level. So other than what I've explained in terms of the actions on climate change, I don't have a legal responsibility in the other areas. You'd have to go to a state minister for those policies.
Question over there. Yep.
Minister, can you comment on the cost of rejuvenating the Murray-Darling Basin?
Question about the cost of rejuvenating the Murray-Darling Basin.
billions. And if you only go to the Water for the Future program, which does include some urban water initiatives, it's not exclusively Murray-Darling, but it's a $12 billion program. We are talking about extraordinary amounts of money that are being invested in making sure that we can keep our production levels as strong as possible and restore the system to health. That's before you get to all the different drought programs and other programs and environmental programs for repairing vegetation and things like that. Before you get to any of that, that's just your water part, and it's the lion's share of that.
There's a question down there, then down there. Yes? On the edge, yes?
You've talked a lot about the surface water management in the Murray-Darling Basin. I'd neglected to say what laws are being thought about for the groundwater management of the basin, and also, as a supplementary, the work that you've done in the Murray-Darling Basin, do you intend to look at other large water basin areas in Australia?
Right, there's a question about groundwater in the basin, and you're going to look at other basins.
Yep. Yeah. We do some work in other areas. There's a whole lot of irrigation in Tasmania, for example, that we've actually helped with to make that far more efficient, and it's providing an important additional income stream in a state that's dealing pretty toughly with a series of economic circumstances that they're in Tasmania at the moment. And sorry, the first part was the
groundwater.
Yep. The answer to that is it depends on what Craig Niles puts in the draft plan. We, in the guide, which was not a formal document, the guide to the draft plan last year, there were groundwater reductions put in. The science of groundwater and the extent of its connectivity is known, but it's hard to do the maths on. And so we will recover groundwater to the extent that the Murray-Darling Basin plan says we should.
So there's a question down there. No, we've had you just down there on the corner here. Just speak up a bit.
I've made a lot of living over the years selling companies to Americans and Chinese and more recently closing them down. How confident are we that the carbon tax, which must by definition impose cost, is not going to create an impediment on business? This has come back from Singapore and Europe, and the world looks pretty bleak out there. And I must say, whilst I'm not a climate skeptic, I do get very worried that we're imposing so many costs on our business relative to our international competitors. And in that context, whilst we save emissions through a carbon tax, but we ship out millions of tonnes of coal every year, aren't we being a little bit hypocritical?
The price on carbon and the package that was announced by the Prime Minister has very generous circumstances for industries that are emissions intensive and trade exposed, up to I think the figure is 94.5% allowance, which then tapers down over time. You compare that to a country that is enjoying record terms of trade, and the best example I can give you as to why I think the argument doesn't hold is the same businesses that occasionally are saying this would be a disaster for them are still submitting applications to me for fresh environmental approvals for further investment. The investment pipeline is not slowing down.
So I just want to anyone, if I missed anyone, so there's a question here. Yeah, we're getting very close to the end, so see how we go. Yep.
Minister, given what you had to say about the value to the water or the river system of buying water in the south as opposed to that buying it in the Darling in the north, and given the fact that that value will probably vary at the point of irrigation, because water in the north is going to be worth probably every bit as much as water in the south to the irrigator, how does a price mechanism work in that situation?
In view of the fact that we've ended up back where we started on water, I think we'll make this the final question. So it's a question about water, and you've got a couple of minutes.
Okay, the water market is not a fully connected market. So if you're in catchments throughout the Murray and the Murrumbidgee, you can trade with each other. Once you get into the Darling system, you can trade within your catchment, and there's some places where you can trade with one neighbouring catchment, but largely you don't have the same style of water market in the northern parts of the basin. So that's why you don't actually get a constancy in the value in different parts of the basin. What needs to be remembered, though, is the environmental outcomes being sought to be corrected don't only go to end-of-system flow down at the Murray mouth. The Macquarie Marshes, for example, no matter how much water we buy in the Murray, unless we buy it in the Darling, we're not going to be able to help the Macquarie Marshes.
Right.
And so the health of that northern system still has environmental assets that provide essential environmental services before you get to their biodiversity value. And to be purchasing, even if only for the value in catchment, it's the right policy.
Minister, many thanks. Thanks. Well, once again, thanks to Mannix for the use of this facility this evening. It's great to have Tony Burke here. As I said, he's been an associate member of the Sydney Institute of long standing, and we've got him here speaking for us. I think all of us have been impressed tonight about the grasp of detail that the Minister has across a wide variety of issues. His portfolio is one of the most important in the government, both now and into the future. And the Minister's come here tonight, given us a speech across a range of issues within his portfolio, taken 30 minutes of questions and answered all of them. So we're very grateful. The speech will be on our podcast tomorrow. I see that Channel 648 on Austar and Foxtel is here, and the Minister's paper will be published in due course in the Sydney papers online. But for tonight, Minister, well done and thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.